Welcome to Main Street on Prairie Public on this Tuesday. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming in the second half of today's show, a fascinating look back to the history of what was once the fabulous Westward Ho Entertainment Complex in Grand Forks. Prairie Public's music host Mike Olson and program manager Eric Dethridge reminisce about a night, March 20th, 1997, and time in the once and still thriving city of Grand Forks, North Dakota. But first, Jeffrey Miller again visits our Main Street studio with his new book, Our Bend in the River, which follows his family's journey transforming their five-acre Cottonwood Bend farm near Kindred into a sustainable homestead. The book blends memories of Miller's childhood on a small farm with his current rural life, celebrating natural living through essays on gardening, tree planting, and sustainability. This is Miller's third book, complementing his extensive freelance writing and monthly column for the Cass County Reporter. Jeff, welcome again to Main Street.
Thanks for having me again, Craig.
This new book of yours, Our Bend in the River, Learning to Live a More Natural Life, seems to me a book that you have been writing because I've now known you for a couple of years, your entire life. Am I right about that?
You are exactly right. Yep, I kind of feel like it's the culmination of 41 years on the earth.
You've organized this book, Jeff, in the seasons. You have spring, summer, autumn, and winter. Why did you organize the book that way? And let's get into the book itself.
So I organize it by the seasons because when you're trying to live a natural life, that's kind of how it works. You know, our new year starts January 1st, but as we all know that living here in the North Country, nothing starts January 1st. So I kind of look at it as the birth of the year, the growing of the year, the harvest of the year, and then the death of the year.
You were an athlete in high school. You've been kind of drawn to the natural environment.
Yeah, so I was born and raised in South Central Minnesota on a small family farm, and I really enjoyed being on the farm. Now, when I look back at it, I also enjoyed sports and all that stuff, but a lot of the memories, the core memories I have are from growing food and having livestock and being around the farm and also being around the wildlife and everything that came with it. So for quite a while, I lived in a small town, and we had a small garden and stuff, but I was very fortunate in 2018 to purchase a rural farmstead along the Cheyenne River. And that's kind of where it started, is I actually now had some land and I have three daughters, so I had some labor, and we were able to kind of start living a little bit more natural. Now, when I say that, people will always ask me,
what does it mean to live naturally?
Yeah, that it's kind of a gray area. For me, we still go to Sam's Club and I still eat a McDonald's hamburger and stuff. But with our family, we try to eat the majority of our consumables, meat, veggies, fruit, things like that, that we can grow. So we haven't hardly bought meat in the store for years. We generally eat the venison or, you know, depending what I shoot that year, a bear or a bison one year, small game, wild ducks and geese and stuff. Well, you know, we eat a lot of that. And then we do a lot of canning in the late summer and eat a lot of our veggies that way. But again, we have three freezers in our house. So I still enjoy Jack's Pizza. The kids still like chicken nuggets. So it's not a completely off-grid lifestyle, but I guess for me, when I call it a natural life, everybody can kind of choose how their natural life looks, and some people it may be simple as having a small backyard garden and making your own salsa, and some people might want to live off-grid deep in the Appalachian Mountains. So it's kind of up to that person, but I think living a little bit closer to the land is going to benefit everybody in the long run.
Tell me about your daughters, two teenage daughters at home. How did they consider this lifestyle, if you will?
So they're teenage girls, so they enjoy hanging out with their friends, playing sports. My middle daughter really enjoys having the open space to play softball. But when they were younger, they wanted to do everything with me. They wanted to go fishing and hunting and trapping. As they've gotten older, they've got friends, they have their own thing, but I think the most important part of it is I want them to know about the natural world. So when they go to college, graduate, get jobs, get married, they understand where their food comes from. They understand how important it is not to waste food. And they still are hopefully will have an interest in the natural world. And I told them, I said, if they want to be interested in photography or hiking, or they don't necessarily have to hunt or fish or trap or anything like that. But I just want them aware of the lifestyle. And you know, when I had my first daughter, I was so excited about it. I was going to take her hunting and stuff. And my dad told me, he goes, you're going to be surprised that generally your kids' interests are not going to be the same as yours. And he was right. And what I didn't want to do is force it on them, because if I force it on them, they're going to hate it. So I kind of let them choose what they want to do. If they feel like weeding the garden or something like that, that's fine. And if not, that's fine too, because, you know, every kid is different. And when you start forcing something is when they really start to dislike it.
Relative to your garden, Jeff, you talk about not having a green thumb, yet you raise a lot of food.
Yep, and a lot of it is just, I guess, blunt force. I plant a bunch of things and make it grow, and I found what grows well for me. Good example of that is I tried carrots again this year, and for whatever reason, I can't grow carrots. I can grow everything else, but so I think this is the last year I try the carrots, because it's not working. And I try to maximize production by growing what I can grow the best and what the family wants to eat. If, you know, I don't grow a ton of jalapeno peppers anymore because nobody but me likes it. So it doesn't make sense to grow hundreds of pounds of those. But, you know, we grow a lot of it. And then I guess for me, the most enjoyment is processing it. And it's nice to go down in the cellar and see racks and racks and racks of canned goods and know that no matter what. And, you know, during COVID, it was kind of an eye-opening experience with food shortages and stuff. And I never once felt like we were going to run out of food. We had all kinds of food. And that was a good feeling, that knowing that even when things were going were difficult, I didn't have to worry about where our food was going to come from.
What are the biggest challenges that you face in transforming the Cottonwood Bend farm into really something that's sustainable? It's underwent changes since you purchased it.
Yep. So actually it was homesteaded in 1887. My house was built in 1887 before North Dakota was a state. And, you know, a lot of changes have gone on since then. But for us, the biggest thing, the hardest thing for me is the weather. You can't control the weather. You can control everything else. You can control what you plant, when you plant, how you plant, everything, but you can't control the weather. And some years it's dry, some years it's wet. And I've kind of got to the point to where we don't do any watering. My trees are old enough now that I don't water them. And you can't do it all. So if something doesn't live, a tree species doesn't live, I'll replant it the next year or something. But we're you know, a couple of years ago we had a hailstorm, and that took out part of the garden. And, you know, it's kind of one thing to deal with, and learning that you can control it, and worrying about it doesn't do you any good. So I've kind of moved that into the rest of my life on, you know, control what you can control. And there are some things you just can't control, and worrying about it doesn't do anybody any good.
You talk about the process and the importance of planting fruit trees and then foraging also for wild edibles. What fruit trees have you planted, and which ones work here?
So we planted a variety of fruit trees. I can tell you the ones that don't work here are peaches. There's a couple hardy peaches that they're zoned for hardy. They will not grow here in North Dakota. I think even if you babied them, you wouldn't get them to grow. So I put peaches on the no-grow list. But we do apples. Apples are slow. Apples require patience. We do a lot of currants. And currants are very popular in Europe. Not real popular here, but they're delicious. So we grow a lot of currants. Elderberry are another one that grow fantastic. And I have a person that purchases a lot of my elderberry for making syrup and things. Plums are another one that are really easy to grow. Native plums. And you can buy grafted plums. And to be honest with you, I don't think they're worth the trouble. You're not going to get the big purple plum like you get at the grocery store. So the native plums grow really well. Black chokeberry, choke cherry, even some cherry species, Nanking cherry, and then we can grow some sour cherries, grow really well. And then we have a really unique one called sea berry, which is popular in Russia. It's an orange fruit that tastes very tropical, which is very unlike what we can grow here in the north. Most of our fruits are astringent, and maybe a little sweet like a plum, but the sea berry is like eating a blood orange. It's very good. They're very easy to grow. They're just not very well known here, and they're also very difficult to pick. They're very thorny. You almost have to battle with the tree to get your fruit. But and we've got to the point to where we have most years an excess of fruit. So I juice a lot of it. We have some grapevines. Grapes are fun to grow.
Do they grow well here?
The cold hardy grapes do. So you got to look for cold hardy grapes. You're not going to grow a Concord grape here, but you can grow, and you're also not going to grow Sauvignon Blanc or, but you can grow cold hardy grapes. And there's some really good wineries around here that make wine into it. I just make it into juice, so I'm not as picky. But they grow really well. They have seeds for the most part, but if you have a juicer, you can make gallons of really good grape juice. And we never add any sugar to our fruit juices. So we have natural sugars, but it's healthier, you know, than drinking the juice you can purchase in the store that have a lot of additional sugars.
The book is titled Our Bend in the River, Learning to Live a More Natural Life. Its author, Jeff Miller, is my guest. He's authored two other books, one, Forever Towards the Sunrise, A Lifetime Lived in the Outdoors, and also Clasburg, North Dakota, Collected Stories from the Middle of Nowhere. Jeff, on the cover of this book, I'm looking at a fruit tree. What am I looking at?
So that's an elderberry. That's an elderberry right about when it's time to harvest.
Oh, boy, it sure looks like that.
Yep. Yeah, elderberries are really cool. They've kind of got a reputation the last few years about being very healthy, and they are. In the wintertime, I try to drink elderberry juice every day. It's not going to cure you of your ailments, but it does seem to help, and it tastes good too. So I really like elderberry. And then whatever we don't pick, the birds get to eat the rest of. So I kind of always like to leave some of the fruit for the birds and let them have some too.
We've asked you to read a couple excerpts for us, Jeff, today. The first one, set it up for us, and then let's hear it.
Okay, so the first one is kind of an interesting story. It's called New Life at the End of My Arm. And when I was growing up, we had livestock, mostly sheep. My mother's grandfather was a big sheep producer in southern Minnesota at the time, and I don't have sheep anymore, but I always enjoyed having sheep. And this one was about kind of an Easter day unlike any other. New life at the end of my arm. As the snow melted and the days warmed, the pregnant ewes, belly swollen with life, would begin birthing their lambs. A pregnant ewe would separate herself from the flock into the corner of the barn and begin pawing at the straw. We would install a couple of panels of hog fencing around her, giving protection from the rest of the sheep. Usually the lambs, as most experienced gave birth to two, would be delivered easily. The cheesy yellow newborns with tightly whirled wool and giant propeller-like ears would wobble on their feet as their mother licked them clean. Soon they would be suckling on the ewe's bag for colostrum, and within a day or two they would be sprightly and wide-eyed, letting the world know they were there by bouncing around like their legs were made of springs. Every so often, though, the ewe would have trouble. The lamb would be breached, tail first in the womb. No amount of pushing could make the lamb pop free, and they would require human intervention. One such occasion occurred on Easter morning. We had been getting ready to head into town to my grandparents when Dad made a cursory check of the sheep. When he came back to the house, things changed fast. We needed to pull a lamb. Since my hands were smaller than my dad's and stronger than Mom's, I was pulling the lamb. In the cool air of the barn, with the flock inquisitively watching, I took my jacket off. Wearing a short-sleeved shirt, my arms were bare. We soaped them up with dish soap, striving for a smooth entrance. When I inserted my hand into the struggling ewe's orifice, it almost was immediately crushed. The heaving of her sides clamped like a vise. Even at my young age, I witnessed plenty of dead animals' insides, from deer to pig to squirrels. But this was the first time the animal was still alive. The ewe, seemingly resigned to her fate, swung her head around and looked at me with baleful eyes. Every time she pushed, her eyes shut tightly. I was up to my elbow when my fingers brushed the lamb's legs. It took a moment for me to get a grip on the slippery surface, but I managed to get my hand wrapped around the legs. With a tug, the newborn slipped forward. Right before the lamb popped into the world, there was a snag, but a slight twist on my part and it popped free. The ewe, despite being physically spent, immediately began cleaning her young. The little fellow stood proudly, as if knowing how close he was to never being a witness to the light of the world.
Winter, you write, is a hard time for you, especially late winter. How do you get through it?
So winter is a very difficult time. So I probably, like a lot of people, suffer from depression and anxiety. And being cooped up in the house during the winter kind of exacerbates that problem. So what I try to do, and when we're not going to wrestling meets for my daughters, is just to spend time outside. And even though it's cold and windy and there's not much to see, just going outside snowshoeing or rabbit hunting or even just feeding the chickens in the morning kind of gives a purpose to life. Because sometimes I feel like it's difficult when we don't have a purpose. And if your purpose is all weekend to watch movies on Netflix, you can get depressed quite easily. So I just try to be active. And as I've gotten older and understood the way that my mind works, I think the best thing I can do is stay active.
Tell me about the greenhouse in Sheldon.
So the greenhouse in Sheldon is part of the United Prairie Foundation, which is an organization that is committed to bringing back prairie. It's really, really a good organization. And they have two greenhouses, the one in Enderlin, they have one in Fergus Falls as well, where all they do is grow native plants. So instead of going in and seeing zinnias growing or any other sort of annuals or even non-native perennials, you'll see big blue stem growing or prairie sandweed or swamp milkweed or any of these really cool native prairie plants that we have. And we, you know, through the Soil Conservation District and also through just Cottonwood Bend Farm, we've put a lot of native prairie plants on the landscape. And they have a really cool mission. They're open to the public, and planting native is always the best way to go.
Do you have some natives on your land, Jeff?
Yep. So we've got some small pocket prairies that we've installed that are really doing well. When you walk out there in the middle of the summer, they're absolutely alive with bees and butterflies. We've also restored about a quarter acre to or a half acre to native prairie. This is the first year it's been there. When you're restoring native prairie, it's a long process. It takes a lot of patience. There's a lot of weeds. It's going to take a couple of years before that really flourishes, but it's going to be well worth the wait.
You do a lot of different things at Cottonwood Bend Farm. What's most fulfilling for you, would you say?
So that's a good question, and I always like to answer that on whatever I'm doing at the time. So in the summertime, what's most fulfilling is to put that little tiny seed or that little piece of cut potato in the ground and watch it turn into something real. And, you know, it still boggles my mind that a little cucumber seed that, you know, half the size of your fingernail can grow this enormous plant. It still blows me away. Then when fall comes, we harvest, and it's nice to see all that work come to fruition. That's during the hunting season, so we're harvesting meat and fur. And then during the wintertime, it's hard to say there's anything favored during the wintertime, but after a nice snowfall, it is nice to get out on the snowshoes and walk around and see all the animal tracks in the snow, because I think a lot of times we don't realize all the life around us. So when you go out and you can watch, maybe follow a set of mouse tracks or some bird tracks or a fox or a deer, and realize that there's all this stuff happening outside of us. And I think as a person that deals with depression, the biggest thing for me is realizing that there's a whole world out there that is going on regardless of us. And I think that kind of can help ground a person to the earth, realizing that all these processes are going, whether we're there or not, or whether we care or not.
You describe wanting to be so active, yet you are a prolific writer. To me, those things are kind of a conflict. How do you find time to write, and what's your process?
So I do a lot of writing in the winter. A lot of writing. The majority of my writing is done in the winter, and my process is pretty simple. I've got a good relationship with a wide variety of editors across the country for different magazines, and what I'll do is I'll send out a bunch of ideas and ideas that are in line with their publication, and once they get back to me and say that they want this story, then it's time to sit down and start writing. And sometimes a story takes me a half hour and it's ready to go. Sometimes a story might take me an hour and I come back the next day and rewrite it. Sometimes the stories you think are going to be the easiest turn out to be the hardest, but I don't take notes. I take a lot of photos. So what I'll do is I'll go back through photos and kind of help that photo help me relive that moment or that point I'm trying to make. But I have a lot of friends that are professional writers, and they have processes. They will put ideas on boards. I don't do any of that. I just kind of sit down and start writing. And then once it's written, I'll have somebody else read it, go through and make sure that it sounds good. And then I send it off to the editor. And I've worked with a lot of the editors so long that I kind of know what they want. And then when I'm writing something, just like some of the stories I wrote for this book that were specifically for this book, then I kind of pass that around to different people and have them read it and see if they like it or not. Because sometimes what I think is great maybe isn't so great.
You've got a second excerpt you want to share with our listeners. Jeff, what do you have for us?
So this one is called River, Love, and Fool. And it's kind of an explanation of why the river to me is one of the greatest places on earth. River, loving fool. A river, no matter how large or small, is a thing of wonder. Without fail, the water trickles, burbles, and rushes towards its mouth. Small rivers dump into larger rivers, while the largest of them sweep out into the sea. My life, like many outdoors, men, is inextricably linked to rivers. Some of my earliest memories are of flinging arrows with a bent willow bow tied with baling twine. Dad would take me down to the nearest river of a tributary of the Minnesota River called the Rush and retrieve my arrows as I arched them at cardboard cutouts of deer. By midsummer, the river was quite low and I could hear the music of the water rushing over the rocks below. My first archery pursuits were of the fin variety, shooting carp and longnose gar near a low head dam in the spring. The fish would rush upstream to spawn where I'd be waiting. A solid fiberglass arrow tipped with a harpoon point attached to my bow by a heavy line would become battered and cracked as I shot time after time into the roiling springtime river. I would only stop when my fingers were too sore to wrap around the bowstring. A local river rat introduced my dad, brother, and I to fishing for catfish in the mighty Minnesota River. While we caught a few of the smaller channel catfish, we were really after the monsters of the river, the flathead. Flathead catfish are supreme predators, weighing well over 50 pounds and possessing tremendous power in their jaws and muscular bodies. Despite our best intentions, the closest we came to landing one was watching as the line sizzled off the reel. The Minnesota River is full of downed timber and logs, and the cats would invariably wrap around a snag and break off. I was introduced to the Red River during college. While I fished very little during those 4 years, I'd make it a point to wet a line during spring finals week. Plenty of free time around the required test, I would toss a worm into the current at Lindenwood Park and relax in the cool springtime air. Not having any idea of how to fish for the catfish that I called at home, I caught very little. Nonetheless, the feel of the current on my line was what I needed most. My first real job after college was that of a geologist, probing the earth with an auger truck to delineate industrial minerals, mainly sand and gravel. Prior to accepting the job, I had never been on a plane and was soon flying out each Monday morning to distant locales. Homesick and lonely, I would soon hunt down the nearest river. I'd dip my hands and feet into the Shenandoah River in West Virginia, the Rappahannock in coastal Virginia, the Kalamazoo in western Michigan, the St. Croix in eastern Minnesota, and the South Platte along the Front Range of Colorado. These new rivers helped bring me into tune with the strange lands and calmed my anxiety. As I grew older and had means to travel to hunt, new rivers called out. The Eau Claire in northern Wisconsin, the Great Bull in Wyoming, and the Missouri in South Dakota felt my footprints, as did North Dakota rivers, the James, Little Missouri, and Red. The move to the banks of the Cheyenne River felt like home instantly. Fishing, fur trapping, hunting, and kayaking on the silty river is a stone's toss from our house. While life is busy and there are always a million things to do, I still take time to feel the current. I may not always have the time for a full day of fishing on the banks. However, a pause under the cottonwood, with the sound of fluttering leaves and dancing water, brings me back to center. At my core, I'm still nothing but a river-loving fool.
The book is Our Bend in the River, authored by Jeff Miller. Jeff, what do you hope people take away when they read your book?
What I hope they take away is the awareness of the world around us and how we can enjoy it without having to have something big. A lot of people enjoy going to a national park or their lake house or something, and that's their exposure for the year to the natural world. And they may live in South Fargo and think, well, there's no natural world here. But growing food, spending time outdoors, kayaking, fishing, hunting, any of that stuff kind of brings you back to the center. And I truly think that the world would be a better place if we all just took a little bit of time to enjoy the world around us.
Jeff Miller is the director of the Cass County Soil Conservation Service. He's authored two books, Forever Towards the Sunrise, A Lifetime Lived in the Outdoors, and also Classburg, North Dakota, Collected Stories from the Middle of Nowhere. And now his third book, Our Bend in the River, Learning to Live a More Natural Life, is available for readers. Jeff, it's been a pleasure.
Craig, it's always fun to talk to you.
Thanks for joining us on Main Street.
Thank you.
More Main Streets ahead after this.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Bill Dean, Realtor Broker with Alliance Real Estate of Bismarck. Buying, selling, investing, and estate planning. Information can be found at BillDeanHomes.com.
Welcome back to Main Street here on Prairie Public on this Tuesday after Memorial Day. I'm Craig Blumenschein. What's the best concert you've ever seen? No one would be surprised if your answer involves an arena, a theater, or maybe even a stadium. Some of us might think of shows at a place like First Avenue in Minneapolis, where Purple Rain was filmed. But for three guys recalling an emerging music scene in a North Dakota city on the verge of a natural disaster, the greatest show might have happened in the tiniest and most unlikely of spaces, with a hand-scrabbled Canadian troubadour at the center. Here's Prairie Public's Eric Dethridge.
My mother always had this fear that if you feel too up, the rug will suddenly be pulled from under you. Now, she earned that feeling honestly. She survived a world war, and her father died suddenly of a brain hemorrhage just months before she was to marry my dad. The wedding ceremony went on, though she wore black. German Catholics, let's just say they're committed. There was a time in Grand Forks, North Dakota, when a confluence of music, the arts, a radio station, and a venue, let's just say, with Riz, so curious and colorful, of course it had the word fabulous in the name, made fans of things like that feel like they were floating on air. But it wasn't too long before that bubble burst.
He spearheaded changing the name of the state and things like that. So
The name of the state to what?
Yeah. So he wanted to take North off North Dakota. And so I remember, you know, just, you know, traveling around town as a kid and people looking at me like, that's the kid whose dad is trying to change the name of the state.
The son is Chris Lindgren, former manager of the fabulous Westward Ho Entertainment Complex in Grand Forks. His pops was Don Lindgren, the character who, along with his father, Armin Rohde, founded the quirky eatery, comedy, music venue, and 12-room motel with a boot-shaped pool back in 1953. When I got to know the Ho, it had a comedy club with candles on round tables called the Gaslight Lounge, a couple of restaurants, a small bar with peanut shells on the floor. It was located right next to the Simplot factory on the northern edge of town, and you could just smell the smell of frozen hash browns being made while you shuffled into the saloons. And when you did, you might even get a rather unusual greeting.
A bird by the name of Sam would welcome the men by saying, howdy, partner, and would actually, this is so true, and would actually whistle at the women.
Oh, no.
In the front.
Oh, no.
So,
Survive the era that we're in today. Yeah, you might think of the old West at the Westward Ho, but with Big Al's pasta parlor and a speakeasy-style bar, Chris says the Windy City comes more to mind.
You know, people assumed when they saw the front that it was a Western property. I would think that it was more like an old Chicago kind of vibe inside. Chicago was very influential on life in the Midwest back then.
There was a night in 1997 at the Westward Ho that will forever stick out in the mind of Chris and longtime host of Prairie Public's Into the Music, Mike Olson. I was there too. Recently, Mike sat across from me in our studios, and Chris joined us from his home in Denver. First of all, describe the room, the peanut bar. What did it look like? Just give us the effervescence of that room.
Well, I always struggled with capacity rules.
you can say that now.
Yeah. Looking back, I think the capacity was about 32 people. It was a classic galley bar featuring adult beverages and free peanuts that you threw on the floor, and then a piano player that could really, really work up a crowd. Fred Eaglesmith was one of the great special editions of Peanut Bar Live, and that's where I met Fred, and we became lifelong friends.
Yeah, I could, speaking of the peanut bar, I could just feel the peanut shells under my shoes just to hearing about that.
Yeah.
The crunch.
I know, the crunch, I know. I keep hearing the crunch as we were leading up to this. Yeah, for sure.
All right, so speaking of Fred, let's get into Fred Eaglesmith. So, Mike, let's bring you into this conversation. You were, as you are now, the host of the long-running show Into the Music on KFJM in Grand Forks, still are. Now you're part of the Prairie Public overall family. But back then, we were known as Northern Lights Public Radio. I was there with you in the 90s. But how did Fred Eaglesmith appear first on your radar?
Okay, well, Into the Music at that time was featuring a lot of the artists that were part of the what they called the alt country movement. And that'd be bands like Whiskey Town with Ryan Adams. The old 97s.
I got a time bomb in my mind, Mom. I hear it ticking, but I don't know why.
Uncle Tupelo.
Come on, do what you did. Roll me under the mattress.
And a lot of the Texas singer-songwriters, like Guy Clark.
I can just get off of this L.A. freeway without getting killed.
Bartlett.
Dale Gilmore, Joe Ely,
yes,
all those guys.
All those guys. Have you ever seen Dallas from a DC 9 at night? And I got this record sent to me, really no information attached to it, by this guy named Fred Eaglesmith. And it was a record called Drive-In Movie.
Well, I'm wilder than her. What else can I say? But I guess that's why she fell in love with me. She's a house on fire. She's got all those charms. I'm a house on fire too, but I got four alarms. And I'm wilder than her.
Well, I'm listening to this record. Man, this guy is killer.
She was just one of your kind, but she's a summer storm. I'm a hurricane. One just blows through town, one blows the town away. And I'm
he's got
what were the songs on that record that really stood out to you?
Well, okay, so it started off with I Like Trains.
Yep.
Fred like Trains and Trucks. I Like Trains. Then he had, I mean, this thing was a very strong record. It had 49 tons.
49 tons of diesel locomotive couldn't drag me back to you.
Here's the Keys. Wilder Than Her.
Wilder Than Her was the big hit.
White Rose. Great song.
White
about
Rose
it.
Filling Station. The gas station.
Yeah, fading. Yeah. The gas station going out of business. Good Enough. Drive-In Movies was the title. I mean, these are all great songs. I thought this was his debut record. Okay, I didn't have, this was kind of like very early days. I don't even know, the internet must have been around, but very early. So I had no real back history on this guy. And so I thought it was his debut. And I thought, man, this guy, this is as strong as John Prine's debut.
Right,
I mean, this
right.
is incredible, yeah. you know. So one evening in, I guess it was March, I believe. And anyway, I get a call from Chris, and Chris says, do you think I should book this guy, Fred Eaglesmith, in? I got a call, and they're going to be passing through, and they'd like to play a gig in exchange for hotel room. And here they were on their way back from South by Southwest down in Austin and heading up towards Canada. And so they wanted to spend a night in a hotel. And so this was their idea. And I said, yeah, Chris, absolutely. He said, well, the only place I can put him is the Peanut Gallery. And I said, perfect. Put him in there, man. Even if you and I are the only ones that go.
Use the keys, take me.
Well, let's back up a little bit. So Fred Eaglesmith, we should mention, he's a Canadian singer-songwriter. It sounds like he's, you know, plucked out of the Texas songwriting tradition, but he's from rural Canada, like rural Ontario. He also, as I recall, he had kind of an iconic little bus that he drove around.
Oh, I'll
right?
tell you this whole story.
Yeah.
Okay, so we made the call to have Fred drop by the radio station.
I remember we were preparing for them, and I was helping to mic up these three guys. You know, there's three guys here now, so we need to get like a guitar mic, we need vocal mic. And they said, Fred said, like, we don't need
yeah,
any.
No,
we don't
no,
need
one
mics.
Mic. So
just
everything,
one mic.
Everything that had been set up. No, get rid of all
just
that.
Just get rid of all that. Just put one mic down on this console, and that's good enough for us. And we're like, what?
Right, but these guys were well practiced at singing around one mic.
So
it's
good.
Kind of like the old bluegrass bands or somebody, you know. And he's got this song called White Trash, where they all sing the Willie and Ralph sing the female part.
Girls.
And White Trash and How's Ernie?
You know, it ended up real bad, but I don't miss her anymore. Don't sure do miss her dad.
These were very comical songs that they had. They did probably three of them for us.
Oh, they're hilarious.
And hilarious. I mean, they had us falling down in the studio. And, of course, this is going out on the air, and people are picking up on it. Literally, when we went over to the Westward Ho, I didn't know if it would be anybody other than, you know, maybe Eric and I and Chris, you know, I really didn't know what to expect. But people had heard it and were coming in.
There were people there. I just remember this big wall of acoustic instruments, and it was just so loud. It was like a freight train coming at you. It's like kind of what the Avett Brothers and Mumford and Sons, you know, do now, like those bands. Like, but back then you didn't see bands like that that just like sort of went in your face like that with those harmonies, those perfect synchronized harmonies. They were just perfect.
Wish I was a freight train, baby. Wish I was a diesel locomotive. I'd come whistling down your track and crashing in your door. Wish I was a freight train, baby. Wish I didn't the heart, you'd need a shovel full of coal just to get me started.
But they were loud as any rock concert.
I tell you, they were my impression of them at the time. I mean, they had such attitude, and it was their backs to the wall. The Peanut Gallery is a very small room, 30, like Chris said, 35 people, although there were probably 45 or better packed in that night.
Yeah.
I mean, these guys had their backs to the wall, you know, front legs stuck out, man. Attitude. They'd play these songs like Freight Train and others, and I mean, these guys were serious, you know, whether the Pogues or the Clash or whoever. Pogues, I mean, they're loaded to bear. Yeah, for a little string band, these guys were intense.
Yeah, they were intense. So I think they started with Freight Train, but Chris, what are your memories of that night? Describe what you saw.
I'm old school. I believe the audience should be very dark so you can be unreserved and enjoy it any way you like it. And then the stage lit up, and I ran sound myself for Peanut Bar Live, so I had it really dialed in. And it was an acoustic showcase, but everybody learned pretty quickly that, you know, we were gonna, you know, rock it as hard as we could. And if people were too comfortable, it needed to be louder. So Willie P. Bennett, as a lot of people probably know, is playing mandolin and harmonica, but he's got an effects board on the floor with about 30 effects. So he was doing everything from traditional picking to, you know, ambient sounds to train sounds. And then Fred with his repartee and jokes, and then Skip, you know, so solid on the bass and harmonies. So, man, from the get-go, the performance was just amazing.
His banter was hilarious.
His between-song setups and stage patter, man, is the best.
He peppered his set with songs that he wrote specifically for the live performance. And let's not forget, you mentioned White Trash with the line that says, and she tells everybody that I've got a PhD, but it stands for post-hole digger. I mean, how great is that? When they played those songs, it was like a freaking freight train. It was loud, and those boys were ready to go.
So we should mention Bill Morrissey.
Yes, Bill.
So during this week, the UND Writers Conference was going on, and we were starting to kind of get things rolling with the station. Like a month or two earlier, we'd helped to bring R.L. Burnside up from Mississippi for the first time up north. So then I had heard that Bill Morrissey, this singer-songwriter who we'd played for many years, had his first novel coming out.
Edson.
Yes.
She thought of heat, she thought of time. She called it an even trade.
And so then I went and approached Jim McKenzie, who was the head of the UND Writers Program, and John Little, and said, you know, guys, we should see if we can't bring him here and have him do a concert for us, too. And so we got Bill lined up. So as it turns out, Bill flew in the very night that Fred was performing.
Wow.
Bill was scheduled to do his show on Friday night, and this was on a Thursday night.
I drove on up to Randolph Heights. There's an old folks home there past the lights. Lucille's sitting out there in the shade.
I mean, Fred had five encores that night. Five encores. I mean, people were standing on tables. We're just being surprised and tickled and, wow, this is it. You know, this is the real thing. And the comedian's show over in the Gaslight Lounge had gotten over, and he came over too because he heard all this hooting and hollering going on over here. And so he had to drop in, and he started to heckle Fred. And Fred's the wrong guy. He has no problem with hecklers.
He's had a few, I'm sure. So they were
going back and forth, and I think Fred was getting the best of that bargain. But,
do you remember that part there, Chris? Does that come back to life there for you?
Drive at 105. Better hurry up if you want to catch me.
What happened was Bill Morrissey was, he heard a radio spot that Fred was at the Western Ho, walked in, and I recognized him, and I sat him down right in front, and he sat 2 feet in front of Fred for the remainder of the show and just, you know, was just locked into the performance. So it was an amazing night. And you mentioned the encores. I got a little generous with some of the rules and stuff back then.
You think?
So, yeah. The audience was into it. The artists were into it. So I just let them go. And it's the first time I'd ever seen this dynamic. You know, there's no green room. There's just the back door to the parking lot. So Fred looked at me, it worked on, and the three of them got up and they were headed out the back door, and half the audience spontaneously stood up and started following them out the back. And that was probably after the third encore, and then they played a couple more, and then they, you know, made a quick move out. But, you know, it was, I'm sure all the drinks were pulled, and, you know, we were probably after that magical hour. I let him roll, and it became a long relationship. And, you know, I still see Fred every chance I get.
And shout out to Willie Bennett and Bill Morrissey, whom we both sadly lost.
We'll sleep out on the ground, and in the morning when we wake up, we'll leave town.
Well, Chris, what happened to the Westward Ho?
A lot of people might not know, but in April 19th, 1997,
something happened.
So the Westward Ho, 30,000 square foot property, took about 18 inches to 2 feet of water. This was after losing our home. My wife Kim and I lost our home. Everyone in my family, all of our homes were greatly affected by the flood. Yeah, the Westward Ho took on a ton of debt after being in business for almost 50 years.
But they tried to take it all away without a how do you do.
I was up there for the equity, let's say, you know, and once that was gone, it kind of took the shine off of things. And I live in a neighborhood called Wash Park in Denver, and I just, you know, all I could think of is I got to get back, you know, there. And I gave it 11 years. And then after 48 years, I just took the keys into the bank like a Fred song.
If he were to write one about the Westward Ho, what do you think the song would say about the Westward Ho and the town of Grand Forks?
Well, I mean, you can't listen to White Rose without hearing the parallels. I mean, come on.
Well, the whole town came out to watch. They paved the parking lot. Somebody hung a ribbon up, and then they cut it down. And that big white rose up on that sign was innocence in all our lives. You could see its neon lights half a mile out.
What did they do? They developed like a hub that was a gas station, and then it lived through its time, and then the gas station went away, and it was the opposite of, they paved the parking lot, and it was back to open field. So from what I understand, the Westward Ho structure is gone, and it's definitely has all the folklore of a Fred song.
That light, stare out at the prairie sky, there was nothing else to do. But now there's plywood glass, where the windows all got smashed, and there's just a chunk of concrete, those old pumps. There's a couple of cars half out of the ground, and that old sign still spins round and round. But I guess a white rose still in the station's just a memory now.
Maybe that night, that time before the flood with Fred, was the balm before the storm. As the water rose and nerves frayed, that musical renaissance, that moment a town's support of the performing arts clicked into high gear, showed what could happen in Grand Forks, like in Bozeman, Montana, or other thriving art scenes and comparable-sized communities, if the sandbags held, or perhaps, after the dikes failed, something to lean on as we navigated lost homes, paused careers, and even mental illness. I developed an anxiety disorder, not from what I lost, there's no comparison to what people lost in that flood, but I'd say from witnessing the losses of others and just the uncertainty of everything at that moment. The flood washed away a sense of innocence and possibilities for Grand Forks, but the music and the memories from a town
that was on the rise before the waters rose, affectionately stay with us, and no looming dark cloud could take that away.
I just stare through the door screen, watch the cars come down the pike, their lights against the sky, like a drive-in movie on a country road that I've seen before. Never like the first time.
That's Chris Lindgren, manager of what once was the fabulous Westward Ho Entertainment Complex, Prairie Public Music host Mike Olson, and program manager Eric Deathridge reminiscing about a night, March 20th, 1997, and a time in the once and still thriving city of Grand Forks, North Dakota. Fred Eaglesmith is semi-retired from touring, though he occasionally performs one-off shows in Canada where he lives today. Dakota Datebook is next.
The 32nd Annual Missouri River Bluegrass Festival is back at the Cross Ranch State Park near Washburn, Friday and Saturday, June 14th and 15th. You can enjoy some great picking with the High 48, Special Consensus, Kohlrabi Soup, Cottonwood, and the Bluestems. There will be great camping and late night jamming. Bring your instrument and learn a bluegrass tune with one of the guest bands on Saturday. The 32nd Annual Missouri River Bluegrass Festival, June 14th and 15th at the Cross Ranch State Park. More information at bluegrassnd.org or on Facebook.
North Dakota Native American Essential Understanding Number 4 is about sense of humor. It states, Native people have a rich history of shared sense of humor that includes teaching stories involving Iktomi, Memegwisi, and Nanaboju. These stories and this unique sense of humor continue to support our resiliency and cohesiveness. In this episode of Dakota Datebook, we'll listen to Catherine Freilich, enrolled member of the Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara Nation, in part two of Getting Through Boarding School.
Or she has other stories about going in and eating, and you could only eat at certain times, breakfast, and you couldn't take any food out. And lunch, and then supper. And the story that her and Regina Shenandoah, when she was still alive, used to tell us was that they had knickers that they had to wear. So they always got hungry when they'd go back to the dorms after supper time. So she said we'd take the biscuits from the table and we'd drop them in our knickers. She said so that when we go out, you know, they wouldn't catch us. And there was peanut butter on the table, so they would take the peanut butter and they'd spread it on their hands. Because when they go out, they'd have to stand and pass somebody who was checking, and they'd have to go like this and turn, and then they'd go out. And so she said, oh, we had so much fun, because then when we got outside and got to our room and we'd take out the biscuits and we'd take off the peanut butter and we had a snack. So they would laugh about that, you know. So humor has helped people, help tribal people survive. It really has.
I'm Sharla Stever. If you'd like to learn more about the North Dakota Native American Essential Understandings and to listen to more Indigenous elder interviews, visit www.teachingsofourelders.org. Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota. Funding for this series is from Humanities ND and the North Dakota Department of Public Instruction.
And that's a wrap for this edition of Main Street. We are very grateful that you spent time with us today. Coming up Wednesday on Main Street, up to 80% of chronic diseases are caused or exacerbated by lifestyle. We'll have a conversation about how the way we live impacts our health. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street, and we hope you can join us then. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.